We have present Senator Green, Senator McGuire, Senator Wagner, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Stedman, and Charlie Huggins. At this point in time, Gary Stevens will probably join us later. Today, we're looking and examining Senate Bill 80, lease expenditures for the purpose of determining the production tax value of oil and gas for the purpose of the oil and gas production tax. We have in the audience that have asked to speak, Mr. Tom Williams, Mr. Michael Hurley, Michael Fraley, and Larry Dietrich will be available for questions. Online, we have Kevin Banks, John Iverson, Judith Brady, Jason Brune, and John Norman. Can you hear okay in the rear? Okay, good, good. Okay, with that, Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move CS for Senate Bill number 80, /M, Bullock, dated 2/21/07, in place of the original bill.
Okay, as a working document. Is there objections?
I object for purposes of discussion.
Senator Wagner has objected for the purposes of discussion. You have your staff here to present?
Yeah, the bill be presented by my chief of staff, Mary Jackson.
Welcome, Mary. Put yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Tom Wagner. It's a pleasure to be here before you. Mr. Chairman, very briefly, Senate Bill 80 amends the PPT legislation that was passed last August of 2006. And it does that with a real straightforward amendment. It does not allow for costs of repair or replacement of improperly maintained or simply not maintained facilities. Senator Wagner believes that the citizens of the state of Alaska should not be responsible for costs that are associated with bad maintenance. And 16 other members of the Senate agree with him. And thank you for that. For the record, Senator Wagner and the sponsor of the legislation and the other body, Representative Kurt Olson, neither one of them have ever intended or do intend to have this turn into a vehicle for a gross tax. The current statutes set out some costs that are already not allowed as lease expenditures, and all we have done is inserted this new provision. And if you go, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to the CS that has been distributed, it's page one of the CS is all existing, page two is existing, and on page three, line 19, is where the new provision is inserted. Also in your packet was correspondence from the Department of Revenue, from the Department of Natural Resources, from AOGCC, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and from DEC. And we met yesterday via teleconference with all of those people, and you can see their correspondence reflected what is now before you as the CS. And Mr. Chairman, all of those people are either here in the audience or online, as you noticed earlier. So the I have also included in your packet a description of the differences between the CS that you just have before you for a working document and the original bill. And again, those reflect the changes that were requested by the departments. For the benefit of the listening public, if I may, Mr. Chairman, briefly go through what those changes were. The first one was on line 21. We added the Commissioner of Natural Resources. The Natural Resources has the leases. They have a great deal of expertise in this area, and it made good sense to include them as part of the consulting group. We deleted the term the chair of in front of the AOGCC. The reason for that was so that any member of the AOGCC could be included as part of the consulting group. We deleted the term relying on and replaced it with taking into consideration. It was thought by the members of the departments that this was a little more general in nature, a little easier for them to work with. And then there was clarifying language in subsections A and B and C so that we didn't just say improper maintenance, we said improper or no maintenance. And other than that, Mr. Chairman, I think that pretty well completes my presentation before you. And again, there are the members of the working group, the various departments are here in the room or else online, and also Mr. Don Bullock, who is the legislative drafter for this, is here. And Mr. Bullock also has some expertise from having served with the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Quick question for Ms. Jackson. Okay. Mary, question for you on line 20 on page 3. It says determined by the commissioner. And then it goes on and names three commissioners. Who are we envisioning being by the commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, the commissioner is the commissioner of the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the reason it's just the commissioner, it's a tax bill, and
no,
it's in his purview, so...
Yeah,
we didn't put that in.
Yeah. No, I understand. I just wanted to make sure that I had it correct.
Yeah.
And you said no maintenance. Could you refer to me where it says no maintenance in the bill? Or it says what I'm reading in line 24 is not maintained. And someplace in your explanation you said...
Yes, sir.
No maintenance?
Yes, sir. On page 3, if we'll go, the first reference is on line 25. It says, related to the repair, it begins on line 24.
Right.
Related to the repair and replacement of property or equipment that was not maintained,
Okay.
Or was improperly maintained.
Okay, good.
And it was, if I may, Mr. Chairman, it was a point that was raised during the teleconference that we had yesterday with the members of the... And I honestly don't remember if it was DOR or DNR that raised it as an issue of, well, you've discounted improperly maintained, but what if it just simply was not maintained? So this was clarifying language.
Right. Yeah. Good. And Senator Ware, do you have anything to add to that?
No.
Yeah. Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious on line 1, page 2, you know, we get into... Well, we have a whole litany of deductions, and number 6 is cost arising from fraud, and I think everybody would agree that that's not appropriate as a deduction. Willful misconduct or gross negligence, and how does that interplay with page 3, line 24, when we're talking about items that, you know, that were not maintained or improperly maintained? And how does that tie in? That sounds to me like it's related to negligence.
Mr. Chairman, basically that's a higher level of proof. And, this has all been discussed before, and I hate to get back into revisiting the whole PPT, but that requires a higher level of proof on those items than it does on what we've got in this amendment, much higher level of proof.
So this is in addition to language, not replacing.
Right. Yeah, this basically is number 19.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we look at the language, where's the line drawn between on the cost? As an example, you may have a line that's or a repair that's $100 million because of...
Yeah, stand by one. I think, Mr. Bullock, are you in the room?
Yep. Okay. Yes,
if you'd come up and join us, please, I think it might be a benefit.
A $100 million issue, maybe it's compressors or maybe it's pipes or what have you. And you may have another one that's $10 million or one that's $1 million. How do you handle that without... I mean, is he... all the expenses going to be audited, or how is that going to be dealt with? Or is it just large items that come to particular people's attention? Or
Through the chair, my name is Don Bullock. I'm with Ledge Legal Services. Everything that will be on the PPT returns will be subject to audit by the Department of Revenue. And obviously, it would just make good management sense to put their efforts where they're most likely find errors or parts of the return that need to be corrected. So they may internally set standards, you know, a deduction above a certain amount might draw their attention more than one of the other deductions that's allowed under this section. But what this bill does is it sets up a standard that the departments will probably implement by regulation, because this language, taking into consideration the standard practices of the industry, is intended to recognize that there are things that you would normally do when you're maintaining a field, and that it's just prudent to do that to avoid repairs, fix something early on rather than wait for a significant failure later. So the job that the commissioner will have is to determine what those standards are, and then to look at what was actually reported on the return and determine the significant variance, if any, from the standard that the commissioner has decided should be the applied.
Mr. Stedman, any follow-ups?
Do we have any idea what we're facing as far as typical, other than what's been in the paper here lately? It's a rather large issue, but just in general, how much, you know, non-maintained or improperly maintained equipment we're dealing with up there on, or across the state? Actually, this is a statewide issue.
Through the chair, I don't know firsthand what the answers are, but I believe there are people here from British Petroleum. There are also people from the Department of Revenue that would be capable of taking in the amount of a deduction and giving you possibly an approximation of the tax effect.
Senator Wilkowski.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I guess I wasn't really asking the tax effect. I mean, that's a conclusion, I guess, but I'm just kind of curious of
the cost, what they've spent on the,
you know, to of improperly maintained and or you know, non-maintained equipment. I'm just kind of curious on the scope that we're facing.
Part of the scope won't be known until the commissioner establishes what the standards are and then makes a decision as to how far away from those standards. I can't say it then, this time.
Yeah. Senator Wilkerson.
Great, thank you. Looking at page 3, line 19, what is the mechanism if there is a dispute regarding a decision that's made, a determination that's made by the commissioner? Do you know what the mechanism is to appeal that?
Yes, I was a hearing officer in the Department of Revenue for 13 years, and the formal appeal function is now into the independent body. What generally is, what I expect to happen under the law is that on April 1st, for example, there's the first filing under the PPT. There's statutory authority for somebody that files a tax return to amend the return within 3 years after the date they file. The Department of Revenue also has a period of time, 3 years, in which they can audit the return, go back, verify the numbers, determine which deductions should be allowed and those that aren't. The department then would issue an assessment, a notice to the taxpayer saying, these are the adjustments we found. We either owe you money or you owe us some more money. And then if the taxpayer disagrees with that amount, the taxpayers would file an appeal, generally initially at an informal level where they get together with the people that did the audit, and this was the first chance where they could explain why they think they're entitled to these deductions. And the department would also have its people there, and there may be, they may continue to consult after the assessment during the appeal process with these other commissioners and with AOGCC as to what standards should be applied. So there are adjustments that are possible at that initial level. And then there's a formal level of appeal. And it could involve such things as expert witnesses that would appear in a hearing like that that would speak to this issue of what the standard practices would be and whether what was done was reasonable, and speak to the issue as whether the deduction should be allowed. After that, they go to court, to Superior Court initially, and then on up the ladder.
But that's Alaska, pretty presumably state court, and then it would go to the state Supreme Court.
That's right, unless there's a federal issue that they give them a ticket to the...
And just on the 3 years, so essentially we could have a situation where there is a report that's filed in April, and that could get amended in 3 years. Did I understand you correctly?
So
we may not know the true expenses that are being deducted.
As similar to the federal system, through the chair, we have a voluntary system where we ask the taxpayers to file initially, and then it's subject to review after that. So either the taxpayer can amend their return to more accurately reflect what the circumstances are.
Move the microphone closer to you, if you would.
I'm sorry. So during that three-year period, the taxpayer has the opportunity to correct their returns, and the department also has the opportunity to correct the returns through the audit process.
Thank you. Senator Wagner?
No, sorry. I was just going to ask him to explain the process through the Department of Revenue on their appeals.
I guess, Mr. Bullock, since this is a new term that was introduced deliberately, not maintained, is that a common term that most people would come to grips with?
Well, arguably improperly maintained, as was stated in the earlier draft of this legislation, would have covered the failure to maintain it at all. And this is just to make sure that you get into malfeasance or nonfeasance issues, and it just, as one person used to say, it's the belt and the suspenders both. It's just to ensure that there's no unnecessary room.
Yeah, so you as a professional are confident with that term, that it can be described, and that the eye of the beholder is not the key?
If it's not maintained, they haven't done any maintenance on it. It's not a matter of legal interpretation. Plain meaning would apply to these terms.
Right. I guess my concern, let's just equate it to a vehicle for a moment, from everything from changing your Castrol to making sure that you do your lube job with your grease gun, and then if somebody says, nope, but you didn't check the air pressure in your tires, and one was 28 versus 30, that may be splitting hairs, but I guess I'm looking at both sides of this so that we understand what we're asking for and whether it can be very quickly dismissed because said, yeah, we did all those, and it was just out of tolerance by a half pound of air pressure. And say, yep, you maintained your car.
Well, I think when they're looking at this deduction, they're going to develop a link between what the error was and what the result of the cost was. An example of not maintained versus improperly maintained with your car is if you didn't ever change the oil, you didn't maintain your vehicle. If you put the wrong oil in, put the automatic transmission fluid in your oil pan instead of the oil, then you were improperly maintaining. You took some effort toward it. So it's a matter of doing nothing as well as the matter of doing even what you should have done, but doing it poorly.
Is there a definition for not maintained?
I think it's just, it's what's its face. It's either maintained or it's not maintained.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just trying to make sure that whatever we're using works for all parties. Yeah, Senator Wagner.
Going back a little bit, partial answer to Senator Stedman. This is not saying that BP is not going to be able to write off these expenses or the other companies involved. It's all this is another tool to put in the toolbox to give this a review to see if we think those should be allowable expenses or not. And I don't want anybody to think right now that this is going to be a punitive act to make sure that all this is not a write-off. It may very well be, or a portion of it may be allowed. That isn't the point of this. The point of this is just to give it a final review by a committee that are able to bring to the table during the audit process certain skills and to take a good, hard and final look at this. BP, in a letter the other day, stated that they plan to write off up to $11 million in credits. Well, if they have 28% of the field, that leaves about another $29 million there that the other companies can write off. So that's almost $40 million. That's a pretty good size chunk of change. And so that's one of the reasons for this bill, to give that a good review and see if that's allowable or not.
Mr. Bullock, would you restate the piece about regulations and clarification so that everybody understands that, that this isn't just standalone? You talked about regulations.
Actually, I participated in the meeting on behalf of Senator Wagner with people from Department of Natural Resources, Department of Revenue, and AOGCC yesterday. And we discussed the authority for them to define in regulations and to make the determinations as to what the standard practices were. So this language, taking into consideration the standard practices, is general authority to them to go out and figure out what those standard practices are, and then so they can apply them appropriately to their audits as they proceed.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Mr. Norman, who's the chair of the AOGCC, spoke directly to this issue, and I think he would be able to expound a little bit more on it. But we talked about developing a standard for reasonable and prudent operator,
right,
which would fit within this framework.
Okay. Mr. Norman, do you have anything to add to that? Mr. Norman, are you there?
A need to promulgate regulations and give more specificity and definition and guidance to be able to rely upon. There are certain standards that are in place. They're generally voluntary guidelines enacted by the American Petroleum Institute. There are societies such as the American Society of Corrosion Engineers, for example. And so were we to be given this task, then in our regulations that we would promulgate, we would have to flesh this out to give meaning. Often, as we indicated in our letter, and even right now today, there are no standard practices that apply across the board to refer to. In other cases, they are evolving just as new technological innovations evolve and types of equipment that were not in use 5 years ago come into use. So it is something that is going to take a fair amount of work to promulgate regulations, and that was the point that Ms. Jackson was referring to that we had indicated yesterday.
Yeah. Questions for Mr. Norman? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just have a question. There's a letter in our packet dated February the 15th, 2007, from Mr. Doug Settles, and I can see where the legal argument is going here. And so I guess to Senator Wagner, the distinction would be if the argument on BP's part was that they were already going to replace certain pieces of equipment, certain parts of equipment that would have been a standard practice and so forth. Is there a place in your bill that takes that into account? In other words, that would be the kind of deduction that they would have anticipated to upgrade and expand and go forward with a regular capital expense. Here, what you want to do is exclude those parts, those expenses that go towards improper maintenance or lack of maintenance. Where does that line fall? And do you think you've taken care of it in here?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the partial answer to that question is, in my mind, would BP and the other partners, would they be replacing that 30-inch line with a 20-inch line had not these corrosion problems come up? It's not the ordinary thing to do to replace a line like that. If it was, I think we'd be looking at replacing the taps line and downsizing it so we got a more efficient flow. It's what they're doing, is taking pumping stations offline and putting in new compressors and new pumps. But they aren't downsizing the line. That line would have functioned very well at 30-inch versus a 20-inch, had not the corrosion been so bad that they decided to take it out. And that's in my mind anyway, so. But the good, follow-up, the good thing about it is this panel of several people aren't going to have to sit and make the decisions. That's why this bill is setting this up. And that's, really not, it is not our job to do that. It's the Department of Revenue.
And just following up, I just wanted to get that on the record, because I think that'll be the point of delineation. And I just wanted to make it clear that there wasn't anything in the bill that prohibited your argument from going forward. And so I wanted it on the record.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Edmund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in the conversation, although most of us here were around when we did PPT, and we went around and around for months. As I recall, the 20% credit was put in place to stimulate development and expansion of our oil basin. And the intent there, again, was to increase the flow of oil into TAPS and to share in the cost of exploration and development with the industry, which is a little different twist than rebuilding infrastructure in an old basin. But in looking at dealing with the older basin issue, we had put in roughly a 30 cents a barrel cost for just normal maintenance of equipment that just wears out over time. So the normal maintenance issue would be dealt with. I'd like to just stop there for a minute, because that's kind of just putting some of these pieces together for someone that's didn't recall or wasn't interested in the other PPT bill, but the old PPT bill, but there's two pieces. And I'm just kind of curious how that 30 cent exclusion plays into the issue of improperly maintained. Clearly, hopefully, there is no such thing as not maintained, and we're just dealing with some different. Yeah, poorly maintained. So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
Ms. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Everybody has notes to that in their
not yet.
Packet. Not yet?
No. Mr. Chairman, Senator Steadman through the chair. Senator Wagner developed with Dr. Van Mieris the 30 cent per barrel, the BOE. And we provided, and I don't know if she has available copies of the memorandum that Dr. Van Mieris sent to Senator Wagner on that very issue. It's 5 pages long. There were several different items, and the title of it, if you look at it, was how to make the PPT closer to a gross tax system. Mm-hmm. And that was the thrust of the 30 cent BOE, was to try to establish a base level. And that 5-page memorandum goes into it at length. So we made that available for the whole committee to take a look at. This was part of the, I honestly don't remember what day it was, but it would have been in the second special session. It would have been the third PPT bill that we did in August, 9th, 10th, 11th. Well, I mean, when the bill, when we actually, the amendment was made on the 30 cent.
3001 or something.
House Bill 3001. First bill was Senate Bill 305. The second bill in the first special session was Senate Bill 2001. The third bill in the second special session was House Bill 3001. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much challenged all my number references for the day. So.
And if you turn to page 5 on that, it pretty well explains the 30 cent amount.
Is my recollection correct then that it was put in place to take care of normal ongoing maintenance in an older basin?
No, it was put in place to bring the bill closer to a gross bill instead of a net bill by disallowing costs, yeah. That's what it was really for and intended to do.
Does the letter say that?
That's the title of the presentation by Mr. Van Mears.
Okay, let's take a brief ease and let the members read the letter. And we'll
penalty.
Are there other questions or comments from the committee? Mr. Norman, are you still there? Mr. Norman, can you hear me?
Chairman Norman has stepped out for a few seconds.
On purpose?
Okay, let's proceed. You have anyone else you want to? Okay.
Unless any of the other ones there wanted to contribute, but they're there to answer questions online.
Right. Ms. Brady? Yes, ma'am. Would you put yourself on the record? We're prepared to hear your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Judy Brady. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. The testimony I'm going to give today reflects the consensus of the members of the association with no dissent. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. As pointed out earlier, just last August, in a third special session, the legislature passed a final version of the petroleum production tax, which was set out to both increase tax revenues to the state in times of higher prices and to encourage new exploration and production. That and the tax offered new credits and shared the risk of certain categories of costs. So we're all pretty sure that it certainly did its job in terms of a higher tax. The letter that was referred to earlier from BP's president, Doug Suttles, talked about their tax nearly tripling from $180 million to over $500 million for the first 9 months of 2006. Not surprisingly, many legislators were enthusiastic about the higher taxes to the state and not so enthusiastic about the credits for the concept of the state sharing some of the risk by providing incentives for certain categories of costs. And of those of you who were involved in this, and many of you were, there were literally dozens of concerns about the new approach. What standards of review should be used, what costs should be included, how to prevent the state from being gamed by the companies, how to prevent the companies from being gamed by the state, how the credits could be used, what the tax rate should be. Then on August 6th, BP discovered the leak at flow station 2 of oil transit line in the Prudhoe Bay. They notified the appropriate regulatory authorities and implemented procedures to stop the leak and clean the spill and began the process of suspending production from the entire field. The House of Representatives was informed just before it voted on final passage and third reading to enact PPT and then passed 29-10. As more information was released, the level of concern regarding the effect of the spill under the proposed new tax legislation heightened. Legislators did not want the state of Alaska to end up paying for the result of spills under the PPT if standards had been ignored. As a result, the section on lease expenditures, what they would not include, as well as the standards, came in for close scrutiny in the Senate. There was discussion of a lot of other standards. Various words were used. They finally settled on lease expenditures would not include costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. All of those words have meaning in law with lots of court cases behind them. It was further decided that costs incurred for containment, control, cleanup, or removal in connection with any unpermitted release of oil or a hazardous substance would not be included. On August 9th, the Senate Special Committee on Natural Gas Development reviewed a new amendment with almost the same language as SB 80, which is in front of you today. The language was introduced twice, first as Amendment 9 and then as Amendment 13. The difficulties were immediately apparent. What does improperly maintained mean? What does diminished capacity mean? Who decides in the first place, an auditor? Does there have to be an incident like the spill? If so, that's already taken care of under unpermitted releases. if an incident takes place, does that mean the state can decide what maintenance costs are appropriate under every circumstance? And if no incident takes place, does that mean the state can decide what maintenance costs are appropriate under every circumstance? Both legislators and State Department of Revenue personnel expressed concern about the difficulties, and after discussion, neither amendment was adopted. Instead, the Senate Special Committee adopted an amendment proposed by Dr. Pedro Van Muren, and he explained in the hearing on August 9th, according to the minutes, that maintenance is a reasonable deduction for PPT, but sometimes hard to decide which expenditures fall into that classification. The simplest solution is to take some base expenditure and over the next 20 or 30 years disallow a floor for the capital expenditures. The flat 30 cents per barrel exclusion, which sets a floor for maintenance costs, according to Senator Wagner, and avoids the problem of a case-by-case decision as to whether maintenance, repair, or replacement is required because of equipment or facilities have been improperly maintained, was adopted. Amendment 13, requiring case-by-case decisions as to the reason for the repair or the replacement, almost identical to SB 80, was not adopted. Dr. Van Muren favored using a proxy in order to have clarity and certainty and to avoid disputes. Now the legislature is again debating the same amendment that failed on August 9th, and the same problems with it exist. I would note that the legislature is not debating whether or not to amend PPT legislation to drop the 30-cent barrel proxy cost, which is used for every producing company, whether there is an incident or not. What is being proposed here is a per-activity decision every time of proper maintenance in addition to the flat surcharge that was intended as a proxy for such a decision. However, it may be helpful this amendment be debated again. For PPT to function effectively, it is important that both the legislators and the industry understand how the legislation works and why it should work as intended. If either side feels gamed, we will not be in court forever, regardless of what kind of tax it is. We oppose, ALS opposes SB 80 for four reasons. First, we believe that the state is already protected from being inappropriately charged with lease expenditures as a result of spill incidents under the current law. Second, SB 80 has unintended but potentially significant implications that will extend far beyond Prudhoe Bay, particularly troublesome in Cook Inlet. Third, this is an ex post facto law that is forbidden under the federal and state constitution. And fourth, and continually troublesome, is SB 80 because of the ambiguity of its language, creates ambiguity throughout the entire PPT legislation related to costs and credits. And before going into our specific concerns, we'd like to express our general concern with the premature and possibly unwarranted assumptions regarding the Prudhoe Bay oil leaks. SB 80 is aimed directly at Prudhoe Bay. There's been lots of comments about what was done and not done, and appears to be based on the assumption that because corrosion on the Prudhoe Bay transit lines were more severe than expected, those lines were improperly maintained. This is to judge BP's conduct and that of Atlantic Richfield as the operator of the eastern side of Prudhoe Bay Field before the BP Arco merger in 2000 without having the decisions of the federal and state regulators and or the courts. We like to believe that companies, like individuals, are innocent until proven guilty. There certainly does need to be the level of concern and scrutiny exhibited by the industry and the state and federal regulators. What we hope to avoid is legislation based on an assumption of wrongdoing that will not only solve a problem, but will not solve a problem, but will create new ones. Real shortly here, I'll go through our four concerns. We believe the state is already protected from inappropriately being charged with lease expenditures as a result of spill incidents under the current law. The PPT laws already specifically disallow costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. SB 80, in contrast, would introduce a completely new and subjective term for judging whether maintenance-related costs would be lease expenditures, and this new term would be the improperness of the maintenance in question. All of the other terms have our common law terms, specifically the law of tort, and the judicial precedent established their meaning go back literally thousands of years. To the extent that the concept of improper maintenance is encompassed by any or all of the other already existing statutory terms, it is superfluous. To the extent it may mean something different from the term already in the statute, the concept of improper maintenance is ambiguous because there's nothing to guide taxpayers or tax administrators about which of the existing terms it is different from and in what ways it is different from each of them. And in effect, waiting for this to go to be spelled out by regulators by three different departments turns the whole question of whether the PPT as an act that is supposed to encourage new production over two regulators. Implications extend statewide. Corrosion is not a problem unique to the fields on the North Slope. It's a challenge everywhere. Sometimes you can slow it down a great deal, but you cannot stop it completely. That means the older an iron or steel structure or facility is, the greater the cumulative effect. Coudeau Bay will mark the 30th anniversary at the start of this year. In Cook Inlet, a number of fields will have their 40th and a few even their 50th. And our members with Cook Inlet's interests are concerned that this legislation, which seems aimed at a particular situation that rose on the North Slope, will affect them as well. There are operations in the inlet area that will eventually need to be replaced or significantly repaired in order to remain in operation. When these facilities and structures are eventually replaced, there is nothing in SB 80 to protect them from claims that they were improperly maintained, and thus the cost of repairing or replacing them are limited or disallowed altogether. This uncertainty over whether the cost will be fully recognized as deductions and whether the tax credits or capital portions of these costs will be fully allowed could lead to fields or facilities being permanently shut in instead of remaining in production even longer. Third, ex post facto legislation is forbidden under both federal and Alaska constitutions. Section 10, Article 1 of the United States Constitution declares that no state shall pass any ex post facto law. And according to Black Law Dictionary, an ex post facto law is a law passed after the occurrence of a fact or commission of an act which retrospectively changes the legal consequences or relations of such a fact or deed. And certainly SB 80 does this. And we are going to be assuming that you have talked to the Department of Law or will about this issue. And the last one is SB 80 creates ambiguity that threatens the effective implementation of the PPT. With respect to providing clarity about how taxes work, SB 80 promises to create ambiguity between its improperness standard and the other well-defined statutory standards already in place for determining which expenditures are proper under PPT. With respect to providing certainty about what a taxpayer owes, this ambiguity under SB 80 promised to engender countless disputes about whether maintenance was improper or not, and to the extent it was, how much of the cost of repairing it or otherwise dealing with the situation should be disallowed. The question of what costs are deductible is central to the concept of the PPT as an incentive to new investment and new production. The tax rate under the legislation is extremely high. The trade-off was in part related to cost sharing and credit. AOGA has already testified that we believe the tax rate is too high. Now we're placed in the position of testifying that along with the high tax rate, the determination of cost and credit will spiral off into a black and never-ending hole of litigation. And I will tell you that we have done this before. From the 70s, 80s, 90s, we've had millions and billions of dollars on the table because of disagreements about what words meant. And if we do that again, after having just got through it the last 10 years, shame on us. We strongly believe that SB 80 is a step backwards in achieving effective clarity in the PPT. We all are concerned about declining oil and gas production. That's the only reason the legislature took such a huge leap to make law unique in the world that has both a very high tax rate in times of high prices and also takes where the state takes some of the risk. There's no other reason to do that if we weren't concerned about production. That's why we're so concerned about the gas, having a gas pipeline as well. When to add language that deliberately adds new ambiguity is truly a step backwards in this whole movement toward increasing production and making in Alaska a place where people can do business with surety that they know what's going to happen in the fiscal system. That concludes my remarks. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Brady. Questions for Ms. Brady?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I just like to mention one thing. Ms. Brady brought up the fact that there are some lines in Cook Inlet that are 50 years or older. Those lines are 50 years. Mainly that's the first two platforms set in Cook Inlet, which I believe were Shell A and C. And to this date, they have not had a problem of the magnitude they had on the North Slope. The oil is different. But they pig those lines on a scheduled basis. They continually inject chemicals, and those lines are very operable to this day. They haven't seen the necessity of resizing those lines, putting new lines in, or anything else. And I don't know when, if ever, those lines will need to be replaced. And that gets to the crux of this whole amendment. And I just checked on that last week because I happen to know the people who set those platforms. Mm. So there you are.
Okay, other comments or questions?
Just,
Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. First of all, Judy's a constituent of mine, so thank you for your testimony. One of the comments that Ms. Brady made was that we had already put in an amendment that clarified that costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence would be a part of that. And I don't see where on page 3, the part she was discussing, lines 24 through 25, if somebody fails to maintain or at all or improperly maintains structures related to the pipeline, I do think that's gross negligence. So I guess the position that I would make here today would be, if anything, the bill here, it's just something to consider, Judy, but maybe a clarification of an earlier statement made by the legislature. Gross deviation, is deviating from a standard of care that somebody would not normally do. And I think the argument could be made, if it's proved or not, I'm not the judge or jury here, that the line was not maintained or improperly maintained, that would likely be gross negligence. So that's just something to add. You talked a lot about going back in time and ex post facto laws and things like that. And one other thought would be, it's a clarification about an earlier statement we made as a legislature.
Okay. We can revisit that issue. And is Mr. Bullock still here?
Yeah.
Mr. Bullock, would you come back up, please, and address that issue? And go ahead, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, I just had a question for, just following up on Senator McGuire's question. Do you consider BP's actions to be gross negligence in this matter?
Were you asking me?
No, I was asking Ms. Brady.
Okay.
Well, if I might, to get U.S. of Senator McGuire.
No, not Senator McGuire. It's of Ms. Brady.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood you.
To the chair. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Please, go ahead, Ms. Brady.
I think what the point was that there is a standard. There are three standards in the law as it stands now, and that is the standard that BP will have to play against, and that is in order for that company to use the deductions and the credits. The standard is a standard that has a long history in law. There's a lot of case law. It's a known standard. And that is one of the standards that any company wanting to use the credits will have to play against.
Go ahead.
If I could just follow, is it kind of industry standard to not inspect your lines for over a decade?
I think think that what's going on right now is that people are asking questions and making assumptions about issues that are being looked at by regulators with both the expertise and the authority to look at them, and that there will be decisions about what was done or what was not done in the proper place and at the proper time.
Mr. Bullock, we have gone back to the issue of not maintained or improperly maintained, and you've heard the comments. Would you just give us a quick synopsis of your view of this one more time as we expanded the conversation?
Right. There were discussions of gross negligence, which is a higher standard of negligence. And what this bill offers, a lower standard, and it comes down to the issue is, to what extent, if a poor decision is made, should the state shoulder the cost? And in existing law, for example, there are provisions, actually in prior law now, but when the tax was on the gross value at the point of production, there were elements that. What was the sales price at the refinery? What were the transportation costs from Valdez to the refinery? What was the pipeline tariff? And there was a prevailing value backstop that if somebody made a bad decision, maybe underpriced the oil relative to other sales of the same time of crude from the same period of time, that the prevailing value of that oil would be the applicable standard rather than the state sharing in the cost of a mistake or a poor negotiation. This is similar to that in that this sets up the standard which these commissioners will decide. What's the standard practice? And if there is a variance from the standard practice, perhaps the state shouldn't share the cost of the decision to vary from the standard practice. This bill doesn't say that BP's didn't maintain their pipeline. What this bill says, if there's a problem, and that the commissioner will look at it and say, this was fully expected. At the end of the life of a field, it's expected that the pipelines might be changed or downsized. I don't know what the answer is, but what this bill does is it allows the commissioner to make that decision and really make a decision as to whether the state should share in the burden of these costs or not.
In the respect that the point was made about retroactivity of the standard?
That there are exceptions in tax law that I can't quote you chapter and verse offhand, but there have been exceptions. The PPT itself was a retroactive law. It was passed in August and made retroactive to April 1st of 2006. That issue is already before the PPT.
Right. But in the case of the standard of not maintained to the occurrence?
Under 4355-165A, it allows lease expenditures that are ordinary and necessary. Even under the ordinary necessary standard in this law as it was passed, it has raised the issue as to whether an extraordinary repair would just be an ordinary expense. The 18 exceptions or exclusions from allowable lease expenditures that are already in the statute are effectively provisions where the legislature has taken the step of saying, if there's any doubt as to ordinary or necessary, these are not ordinary and necessary because these are expenditures that may not be deducted.
Senator McGuire.
And if I might, Mr. Bullock, I'm trying to go back into my memory about civil gross negligence. I believe it is a conscious disregard of a known risk. Am I wrong?
I think that goes a long way toward it, yes.
Okay. So my point earlier was, to the extent that an ex post facto law or argument, pardon me, were espoused, it seems clear to me that the earlier version of the bill that was drafted on page 2, line 6, which discussed costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, and gross negligence, seems to dovetail to me with page 3, 24, and 25. If something is not being maintained at all or being maintained improperly, to me, and you can show there's a conscious disregard of a known risk to me. So explain to me where we're lowering the standard.
It's the awareness of the risk. You know, okay. The classic, if you shoot the bullet into the train, you're going to hit the train, or you're going to hit people on the train. If you shoot the bullet into the field, it might be all right. There's a lower risk of something happen. Okay. So there's foreseeability that is often considered in defining gross negligence as opposed to simple negligence.
Following up on that point, you're not an expert, but I suppose this is where the commission would come into play to ask whether or not maintaining at all or improperly maintaining a line consciously would be a known risk. I mean, whether that's a known risk, whether anyone's ever been able to do it
well
and had success at it.
It's part of it starts with identifying the standard that says we expect that certain things to be done. And if those things aren't done, it doesn't necessarily mean it's gross negligence. It okay. just means, it goes back to law school and torts. What would the reasonably prudent person do?
He was a reasonable man, as I remember it.
Yes, that was the old days.
Always made me mad.
That's back when men were more reasonable, I guess.
Yes. Yes, perhaps.
So what it is, you know, it's what you expect. What do you reasonably expect somebody to do? And
right.
if they don't, and there's a cost involved, who should shoulder the burden of the cost?
Right.
And that's what basically the tort principles are about.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. Any other questions for Mr. Bullock?
I have a question. I'm not sure
Senator
if it's
Green.
For him or not. But I was interested in, because I was thinking along the same lines when Mrs. Brady was talking about, if no incident takes place and changes, repairs, or whatever are made, is that going to be reviewed by this panel of people?
That's a good question.
Because that really, then, are we doing something that would deter or discourage someone from doing aggressive repairs, replacement, maintenance?
If I could speculate as to what the department might do.
You may speculate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What we have are 18, in the current law, there's 18 things that can't be deducted or puts a limit on them in the case of the 30 cents. So obviously, this kind of tells the department, look for these things first to see if the return that's been filed is just inconsistent with the expectations in the law. And then if they find things that are in this group, then they'd pursue it further. In the case of a major capital expenditure that might be subject to this provision, you know, they may overlook the few $100 pumps or maybe a couple $1,000 pumps and just ordinary cost. But if there's an extraordinary expense, they may look at that more carefully to make sure that it fits in with the reasonable, ordinary, and necessary expenses that are lease expenditures.
If I may. Okay, in beginning on page 3, lines 19, et cetera, it talks about the commissioner in consultation with the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Okay, by adding it at that point, then, does it mean that all of these things through 18 are going to go through a different vetting or a different review group?
The standards, and based on the request I have from the senator, those others are subject to a different, they all have standards within them as to whether or not they're okay. deductible. This particular one says that we're concerned with how a field should be operated. And what this does in particular is, what is the industry standard for taking care of it? And these other commissioners each come to the table with their own expertise that can help the Commissioner of Revenue determine what the reasonable standard is before the commissioner then determines whether there was a variation from that standard. It's unique, you know, this consultation with the other commissioners relate to developing the standard of what should have been done.
So without this language, everything through 18 would just be done however they do it with their tax review panel? Or
I believe that's correct. I mean, basically it's a tax issue like any other issue.
Right.
There are deductions you can have and deductions that you're not allowed to have. And in this case, this is, because it's dealing with what the standard is and whether the standard has been varied, it involves more than just the Department of Revenue conducting an audit as to
expenses.
And
it's still for purposes of tax?
Yes. That this is a deduction to get to the taxable value of oil that's subject to the PPT.
Senator Wilkowski and then Senator
Yeah, thank Blair. You. So as I understand this statute, if an oil company was out there or a producer was out there and they were maintaining the lines, they were running pigs through their lines, they were inspecting the lines, they were doing what they could, but the line gets old, it's 30 years old, then potentially they could write that off under here. However, if they've failed to inspect their lines or if they've improperly maintained those lines, then what we're saying is, well, you can't deduct that. We shouldn't, the Alaskan residents shouldn't bear the burden of having to pay that. Is that an accurate framing of what we're trying to do here?
It is, but you always keep in mind whatever the standard that these commissioners expect would be normal would be the starting point. They'd say what should have been done and then, in fact, what wasn't done. And if what wasn't done, does it amount to not doing maintenance or doing what would be expected to be normal maintenance, but they didn't do what was expected?
And if I could just, so, yeah, is there, there's probably millions of miles of, well, I don't know about millions, but tens of thousands of miles of pipeline all across the world, and I imagine these pipelines have been in existence for decades, and there's probably a pretty well-established body of how you take care of these pipelines. Is that fair to say?
I can't speak to that, but that's why in this particular piece of legislation it's directed at the people that would be in a better position to answer that question.
Senator Blair.
And following up on Senator Green's comment and question, I guess, is John Norman still on the line?
Yes. Mr. Norman, are you there?
Yes, I'm on the line.
Okay. Also a constituent. I kind of want to direct it to him. One concern I would have would just be a general, everybody is here, I guess, a general deterrent that we might have for, again, regular maintenance. That'd be one for the existing operators, and second would be for those that might want to come to Alaska and invest. And I guess what I'd like to hear from you is, after all of this is resolved with BP, is it your intent, and would you think it'd be prudent, and if you don't, I'd like to encourage you to believe it would be, to set out a set of guidelines by which an operator would know what is proper maintenance? Is there a log that should be kept? Is there some kind of a way that that folks in the business can know that they're covered and protected? And, you know, one thing we hear all over and over, no matter what industry it is predictability. And the idea that it's pretty scary looking up at all of us here. We have a lot of power to change people's lives and the jobs that flow from them, the money that flow from them, and we ought to do it in the right way. And so we have to be careful not to have a knee-jerk reaction on one thing that may admittedly be wrong, I don't know, but not end up in a place where we deter investment in Alaska and we make it an unpredictable business environment. So I guess I'd like to hear from John Norman about what could be done in the future to set up some kind of parameters by which resource development companies could have some expectations.
Mr. Norman, did you hear the question?
I did, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the question and through the chair. The way I would perceive this is there's no question this will be a difficult assignment because in looking for improper maintenance, substandard maintenance, some maintenance operations will be obvious, but as has been discussed by the committee already, many of those will fit under subsection 6. They may even rise to the level of willful misconduct. And I want to add a disclaimer here. I am not speaking to any specific situation, and so I do not want to prejudge any situation at this point, because should the legislature enact this and task us with this assignment, then I want to be able to look at it without having previously expressed any opinion as to any particular maintenance situation as to equipment. And I think you can appreciate that.
Yes.
But the point I want to make is that the obvious cases of improper maintenance, the very obvious ones, will certainly be picked up already under subsection 6, and I would expect them to rise to the level of gross negligence, and in some instances perhaps even willful misconduct. What we're looking at right now under subsection 19 is beginning to slice the bread pretty thin, and it is a very difficult assignment that will be presented to us, one which we will do to the best of our ability. The way that I would approach it, if it is presented to us, would be to begin work on promulgating regulations to address the question that was put to me, to try to give some predictability. But I have to say right now, on the basis of having practiced law for many years, that I do not believe it will be possible to foresee every situation, every compressor, every pipeline, every improper additive of lubricant, and so forth. And I think we would have to fall back upon some of the general standards, and there are many, that exist in case law. The standard of the prudent operator is a standard that is repeated. Also, the standard of good and workmanlike manner are in accordance with best engineering practices. These, again, are general standards that would lead us, in some instances, to cases. I know the FERC has its own definitions of prudent operations that they do apply to pipelines. And so we would do our best to incorporate some of those definitions, and also we would look at, as I mentioned before, the API, American Petroleum Institute, and other professional organizations that have committees of experts that work on what constitutes maintenance. But again, having said all of that, technology is constantly evolving, and whatever standard you lay down today may not hold true 5 years from now. As I indicated in my letter also, there would be a question about the time that a particular decision was made to configure a system in such a way that sets in motion a chain of events, and that may not be the best standard in light of today, 2007, but perhaps at the time the decisions were made, that was a good standard. So there are an awful lot of subtleties and nuances once you get outside gross negligence, willful misconduct, obvious maintenance, and we would do our very best to do exactly what the question anticipated, and that is to try to describe in regulations some standards that would give predictability. But I know before we even start that it would be an impossibility to anticipate everything that might go wrong. We would also, I think, try to do it with a measure of common sense and try to avoid the temptation to apply hindsight, because we do not live in a perfect world and things don't always go right. I do know that there are some parallel decision makers that would be looking at the same thing, certainly for federal income tax purposes. Certain deductions would have to be classified one way or another, and the federal government would have an interest in this. Certainly over and above the PPT for state corporate income tax purposes. Again, decision makers would have to make a decision as to whether this is an allowable deduction. And finally, under applicable unit agreements, which exist on virtually most of the fields in Alaska, each operator has a partner, and for purposes of determining whether you can allocate these expenses across the different partners, the question normally is asked, there are different standards in different operating agreements, but the question does come down to, was this conduct that would rise to the level of what would have been done by a prudent operator? In some agreements, ordinary negligence is recognized as something that does occur, and it's negligence outside that standard that is disallowed. The reason that that has undeveloped in the law is that often operators would be reluctant to assume that responsibility if they knew they were going to, in effect, become an insurer of a perfect result. Right. So that's something that would be on my mind as chairman of this commission if this passed and we set about as best we can. And I want to underscore, we would do our best to implement it, but we would try to strike a proper balance. We would try to incorporate and reach out to adopt professional, well-thought-out standards, and we would look at the case law, specifically definitions of the prudent operator standard and the good and workmanlike manner standard that have been repeated. And then applying those, we would make our best judgment and render advice to the Commissioner of Revenue.
Senator McGuire, follow up.
Great.
Yes, Senator Green.
Yeah, on something else that is in the letter from Mr. Norman, on page 2 at the beginning of that, is finally one can never lose sight of the fact that significant technological advances have occurred as a result of innovations, which at the time were departures from standard industry practices. Also, engineers sometimes learn more through failure than success. Often, there is no indication something is being done improperly until a failure has occurred, but it's through analyzing the failure that the root cause can be determined and changes made going forward. It's a pretty strong paragraph.
Mr. Norman, would you like to expound upon your letter?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I was attempting to do there is to signal, if you will, or indicate that if this assignment is given to us, we will undertake it and we will carry it out to the best of our ability, but we would do it in an atmosphere where we apply common sense. That paragraph that was just quoted was intended to remind all of us again that life and technology is a constantly evolving learning experience. And so what we would do, perhaps foreseeability is a term that is familiar to lawyers, and that is one of the basic elements in conducting a negligence analysis, is was this foreseeable? And if a prudent operator or an operator functioning and carrying out operations in a good and workmanlike manner could not be said to have foreseen this particular outcome, then it would be unfair to penalize that operator. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was attempting to address here. I don't know that I wrote that as clearly as I perhaps could have, but that was the tone that I was trying to give some balance to this, which would be a fairly difficult assignment for us.
Thank you.
Mr. Norman, let me refer to your letter for a moment and just read you. We do, however, wish to point out some of the practical difficulties that may arise in determining whether maintenance has been improper. And then I take your statement and I go to the term not maintained. Does that complicate your life or simplify your life in defining what that is?
I think it it simplifies it. The not maintained was added, and if something is simply not maintained, period, I understood the suggestion or the reason that was offered that was added, and I would say it simplifies it because that's a no-brainer. Again, to use the analogy of your car, it might call for a particular weight of oil and a frequency for changing that oil. And should you fail to do so, you risk damage to your engine. So that is something that would be looked to insofar as failure to properly maintain. But if you just flat ignored it and didn't add any oil at all and did nothing, then I think that is an easier call. Than if you added, let's say, 40 weight oil when you should have added 30 weight, for example, and caused damage to the engine. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask if I answered the question or did I confuse it by my attempt to make an analogy?
Yes.
Then I will rest on the
computer. Is your last name Mason or Norman? Which
Norman.
Is it? Norman. I got it. Now, thank you very much, Mr. Norman. My assumption, you'll prove to be invaluable before we get done with this process.
Yeah.
We're nearing our time limit here. Let me just make an announcement to everyone that's here, and then we'll get back to the subject at hand. Next Wednesday, we will have two meetings of Senate Resources. The first will be from 12 to 1:30, which will be a joint House-Senate resource meeting. And then at 3:30, at this location, we will revisit Senate Bill 80. I apologize for those that were anxiously awaiting their opportunity here today. Bear with us because this is important. I think some of the people in the audience know it's more important than I can emphasize to you. We're trying to recognize the importance it is to all the players. I agree with Senator McGuire, the piece of predictability and people being able to understand about what we as a state want and so they can meet those expectations, and that we want to be customer friendly, not scaring customers away. That's an important, I appreciate your making that particular point. Be that as it may, we have to get through this, make a determination. This is the third time we've looked at this provision, but it's one that's on the table, and we will give it due time, ever what that may be. Mr. Bullock, what do you have?
I have nothing further unless you have another question.
Other questions or comments from the committee? Thank you very much. We appreciate the discretion of everyone. Thanks. This is adjourned.